You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Hurricane Gustav, which has killed more than 70 people in the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and Jamaica, is now battering the Cayman Islands as it moves towards western Cuba.
Most of the main roads have been washed away too, leaving villages and those who live there isolated and in desperate need of help.
Six people are dead in central China after heavy rains caused severe flooding. Another 500,000 people have been affected.
Some experts say the flooding from the Kosi River that rises in Nepal is the result of global warming.
The year the heavy rains fell. I'm Alex Smith. Global warming has become global disruption. In the next hour, we'll take a whirlwind tour of the damage and peek at the new science of extreme rainfall events. You'll also hear a brand new full-on interview with George Monbiot, British columnist and activist, author of Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. His new book is Bring on the Apocalypse, but it's not what you think. Monbiot coming up shortly.
It would be the perfect storm.
Now that we're back from one of the crappiest summers ever, shall we find out why? What happened to global warming? Back in the early 1990s, Greenpeace launched their new climate change campaign. Even then, it was apparent that global warming was the end result, but the next few decades would really be the time of a rocky shift in weather. It's too bad the label global warming caught on in the press. As the recent head of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science told Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, we've misunderstood our situation.
We are talking about the overall issue of global warming, and I'm joined here in Aspen by one of the country's top scientists, John Holdren. He's professor of environmental policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and director of the Science, Technology, and Public Policy Program at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. He's also director of the Woods Hole Research Center and just completed a term as board chair of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Professor Holdren, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good to be here.
This term, global warming, you don't like it.
I don't like the term global warming because it's misleading. It implies something that's mainly about temperature, that's gradual, and that's uniform across the planet. And in fact, temperature is only one of the things that's changing. It's a sort of an index of the state of the climate. The whole climate is changing. The winds, the ocean currents, the storm patterns, snowpack, snowmelt, flooding, droughts. Temperature is just a bit of it. It's also highly non-uniform. The largest changes are occurring in the far north, in the Arctic, in the Antarctic Peninsula, in the far south. It is certainly not gradual in the sense that it is rapid compared to the capacity of ecosystems to adjust. It's rapid compared to the capacity of human systems to adjust.
How extreme is the situation right now?
I think that most people, even most scientists, continue to underestimate how far down the path to climate catastrophe we've already traveled. We are committed, the United States and 190 other countries are committed under the Framework Convention on Climate Change to avoid dangerous human interference in the climate system, and the fact is it's already too late to do that. We're already experiencing dangerous interference. Floods, major floods, are up all over the world.
Incidentally, Amy Goodman and her camera crew were arrested in St. Paul, Minneapolis, while filming protests outside the Republican National Convention. Amy was roughed up and carted away, along with an Associated Press photographer, too. That may seem like a good way to silence critics or hide dissent. But Amy Goodman broadcast through 700 television and radio stations worldwide. The major networks just covered the empty seats inside and the empty political rhetoric handed out by the talking heads. You would never know. The American people are wildly opposed to the Iraq war. They are also deeply worried about climate change, but that is just a minor talking point in the campaign so far. Americans' feet are wet. The American people have already been burned out, flooded out, and are running scared from climate disruptions. A major U.S. city was just evacuated. Record floods and rains hit the South, the Northeast, the Midwest in recent months. These storms that drop 1, 2, 3 feet of rain, up to a meter of rain in 24 hours or less, several inches a minute sometimes, are popping up all over the world. They were predicted by climate scientists. They are called extreme rainfall events. It is just part of this climate disruption. Heavy rains are wiping out crops, damaging billions of dollars in buildings, destabilizing hillsides, flooding national capitals, starving and displacing millions. It's time to realize so-called global warming has many faces. In fact, the changes are so complex, our fastest supercomputers and our most brilliant scientists cannot predict, track, or really conceive of the super historical developments taking place now. Take the heavy rains. I first tuned into that around 2005 with some strange floods in Great Britain, and those turned up again in 2007. Towns and buildings that had not flooded since medieval times went underwater up to their windowsills. All Europe experienced floods in those years from rampant, sudden rainfall events. This year, the phenomenon went worldwide. You could almost call the past summer an extended global rain event. As you know, the governments of the world have commissioned a series of studies on climate change. This is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Now, they predicted that rainfall would increase as a global average. The physics is easy and undeniable. Warmer air holds more moisture. That's it. Warmer air holds more moisture. And the world's atmosphere is getting warmer, so it must get wetter. Though the IPCC wildly misunderstood a second contributing factor, how fast the oceans would warm up, just last year, Australian scientists led a team showing that oceans are warming 50% faster than the IPCC predicted. These warmer seas release still more moisture into the air. All this water has to come down somewhere, and it still falls where rain is common, and avoids the desert areas, which in fact become drier yet. It's one of those weird, peculiar things about climate disruption. There may even be another catalyst for extreme rain, the increased particles floating in the atmosphere, mostly from industrial activities and coal burning, but also from cutting down forests and increasing industrial agriculture. If you could see the Earth from space, with special glasses showing dust, you would know there is a brown cloud surrounding our planet. We're kicking up dust. And it is possible that rain collects around these particles, adding to extreme rain. I don't know if that has been proven yet, but it makes sense to me. But we do know these heavy rain events are part of global warming. Scientists Richard P. Allen of the University of Reading, UK, and Brian J. Soden of the University of Miami, Florida, have published a paper in the journal Science for August 8th. The pair used satellite measurements and computers, finding a direct link between warming and increased extreme rainfall events. Strangely, the extreme rainfall stuff we've experienced are even heavier than computer models predicted. We don't know why yet, and we have to find out soon. Humans, you and I, are affected by the weather in so many ways. Many Canadians felt cheated out of their annual dose of summer weather this year, getting cold rains instead. Americans in the South have felt fear and disruption from heavy rains. Some became homeless because of record rainfalls and the floods that followed. I wonder if unstable weather also creates uncertainty about the economy, about the future and self. People in the developed world have also learned their storm sewer systems, your drainage plans, and dams are no match for these superstorms. Millions in the developing world lost much more. The farmers of Bihar and India are left with nothing but a few rags to wear, homes, cattle, roads, crops gone. The same tragedy has been replayed in Vietnam this year, Laos, Nepal, and southern China all very recently. This is the start of a vast disruption in human affairs. Step 1, of an uncontrolled experiment with the deepest workings of nature. We need to hear from George Monbiot. If you don't know him, millions do. George has avid readers of his column in the UK's Guardian newspaper. You can check that at monbiot.com. His book, How to Stop the Planet Burning, stayed on the bestseller list for quite a while. Monbiot is also widely known as an activist against more highways, airports, coal, and other climate-wrecking projects. His new book is called Bring On the Apocalypse. Do we need a revolution to protect our climate? Can the current setup ever deliver justice for everyone? Let's dig into some of those big questions with one of the leading public intellectuals of Great Britain, George Monbiot. Welcome, George.
Thanks very much, Alex.
It's been almost 2 years since we recorded your tour speech for the book, How to Stop the Planet Burning. It's one of the few practical guides out there. But you have changed a proposal on carbon rationing. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. It's not that I think that carbon rationing is an inherently bad idea, but that I think someone's come up with a better one. There's a new book out called Kyoto 2, published by a man called Oliver Tickell, and he points out that there are quite serious problems with implementation as far as everybody having an individual carbon ration is concerned. And it might be better to try and turn off the tap at the beginning of the pipe rather than at the end of the pipe. In other words, rather than trying to deal with all the little droplets coming out at the end of the sprinkler, to actually turn off the tap at source and seek to prevent the extraction of fossil fuels in the first place. And in other words, the people who will be rationed under his system would be the companies as far upstream in the process as possible. So he's identifying in particular refineries, coal washeries, the big businesses which are producing most of the fossil fuels. And what that would enable us to do is to regulate a few thousand entities rather than having to regulate 6 billion people.
Well, we could certainly start with the tar sands in Canada. That could use a lot of rationing. They're just building it up and up, as you know.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing that this development is expanding just as we become more aware than ever before of the urgency of the task required, that we need to prevent 2 degrees of global warming if we are to avoid some of the worst impacts of climate change. And these tar sands alone commit us to a major chunk of warming, and it's quite disgraceful that Canada is expanding these operations.
Well, in a recent Radio EcoShock program, we did a mashup of radio clips from this year's climate camp at King's North, the coal plant they're proposing at the UK. How is it possible that green-talking Britain is going back to this climate-killing coal?
Well, this is something which is possibly taking place worldwide, that as supplies of natural gas become more fragile, less reliable, are concentrated in the hands of fewer nations, including some of those that our governments distrust, there's a drive to turn to a more reliable fuel, in other words, one that can be stored more easily and one that's distributed much more widely across the planet, which is coal. The trouble is that coal is far more carbon intensive than natural gas. And to give you an example of the potential impact of this, in the UK, we, in common with all other developed nations, should be cutting our carbon emissions by at least 90% if we're to have any chance of stopping runaway climate change. There are currently 6 new coal-burning power stations in the pipeline, in the planning pipeline. None of them have yet been approved, but they're currently being discussed by the government. If those 6 power stations alone were built, that would account for 10% of our current emissions. In other words, for the total sustainable emissions of the United Kingdom. We could have those power stations, but we could have no roads, we could have no other power stations, we could have no heating in our homes. Every other source of energy would have to be terminated if those 10 power stations were built. And it gives you some idea, those six power stations rather, it gives you some idea of just how unsustainable the construction of new coal is. And what we were trying to do at Climate Camp was to prevent this development from going ahead and to demand instead a massive investment in renewables.
We're talking with activist, author, and Guardian newspaper columnist George Monbiot. In just a minute, we'll get to his new book, Bring On the Apocalypse. But, George, a few anarchists at that climate camp claimed your program for government action will lead to green Stalinism. It's a thorny issue. We hear the same objections from people here in North America. What is your response?
Well, the problem we've got with climate change is we have to have a very rapidly implemented program which is also very far-reaching. We're talking about a 90 or 95% cut in the emissions of the developed nations. And it has to happen, it has to start happening straight away, and the whole thing has to happen by about 2050 if we're going to prevent 2 degrees of global warming. So we have to start from where we are. We can't summon up a perfect society in which to conduct these enormous cuts. And at the moment, whether we like it or not, the great majority of power and money is concentrated in the hands of governments and corporations. And unless we can mobilize them to implement these cuts, it's simply not going to happen. If we have to wait until an anarchist revolution has taken place and everybody's living in autonomous communes, well, we could wait and wait for that, and we'll see runaway climate change destroying everything which the people at Climate Camp and elsewhere claim to value. And so the idea that these cuts have to be preceded by the dissolution of state power and of corporate power means, in effect, that these cuts will never take place. And then, even if you somehow achieve that supposed utopia, it actually, in my view, is incapable of delivering what needs to be done. I was just in a correspondence, actually, with a Canadian person, a Canadian anarchist, who was saying, well, you know, all we need to do is to get out of our cars and cycle and build homemade wind turbines and generate our own electricity. And that illustrates very clearly to me what the problem with that model is. If you have a micro wind turbine on top of your house, at best you will be providing between 5 and 10% of your own electricity. If you've made it yourself, as this man suggested, it's going to be a lot less than that because it'll be less efficient. And the great majority of people live in cities in which the wind scarcely even reaches the cut-in speed for a micro wind turbine. And it's just completely useless as far as cutting carbon is concerned. By all means, we should be cycling more and leaving our cars behind. But unless there's also a government which is changing the infrastructure, in other words, which is reducing the space allocated to cars, all your decision to get on your bike will do is to free up road space for someone to drive a less efficient car than you would have driven. And these are just a couple of examples of how that disaggregated approach, of a decentralized approach to trying to deal with climate change, simply cannot match the scale of the challenge. And in order to achieve the cuts that I'm talking about, we need, unfortunately, to go just the other way. We need to start building very large-scale renewable energy farms. We need supergrids stretching across continents in order to tap into the best sources of ambient energy. We need new public transport systems. And these things cannot be autonomously organized by anarchist communes. There has to be a state involved, and unfortunately, it seems to me, there also have to be entities which can mobilize large amounts of money involved, which we call corporations.
I don't think that argument's ever going to end, and I think you've made a pretty good explanation there, in my opinion. I want to move on to your new book, Bring On the Apocalypse, Six Arguments for Global Justice. The title seems to imply that we need more than just climate campaigning. We also need global justice. What does that really mean, global justice?
Well, I suppose it means the same as justice anywhere, except it has to take place at the global level. And one of the great democratic deficits we have is that there is currently a great deal of governance at the global level. We have organizations like the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization and the United Nations, the Security Council and the General Assembly, wielding a good deal of power and influence, particularly over the poorer nations, and yet there is no democratic recourse whatsoever at the global level. We have structures of power, but they are accountable to no one, except in theory the national governments which give rise to them, but those national governments are elected on domestic platforms, not on international platforms. And so there's very little contact between the wishes of the electorate as far as international issues are concerned and the complexion of the government that gets elected. And so to have anything approaching global justice, we need to see a massive democratization of global governance. At the moment, for example, the IMF and the World Bank are exclusively controlled by the nations of the G8, in particular the United States, which has a blocking veto within both organizations on all items of business. And that means that while these organizations work almost entirely in the poor nations now and exercise great power over those poor nations, they are exclusively controlled by the rich nations. It is a dictatorship. There's no means by which those who are affected by those organizations can influence their policy. And that has to change. And among the measures I would like to see happening are the creation of a world parliament whose purpose is to review and challenge the decisions made by these remote and inaccessible bodies, a major restructuring of the United Nations so that its decisions are not controlled by the five permanent members of the Security Council, the closing of both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which are structurally and constitutionally destined to fail, and their replacement with an international clearing union of the sort that John Maynard Keynes first proposed in 1944, and a complete shift of the agenda of the World Trade Organization to turn it into a fair trade organization, whose purpose is to ensure that no international trade can take place unless it meets the criteria for fair trade.
Well, those are some of the top-level solutions. I think, you know, my personal reaction down here on the ground is that we as a consumer society also need to think about the justice in the things that we purchase and the rights that we claim over billions of other people elsewhere in the world. Would you agree with that?
To an extent, I think we are very weak as consumers, and we always will be very weak as consumers. Consumer democracy is a misnomer, not least because some people have more votes than others, in other words, more money than others. And those who have the most money are the least inclined to use it to change the system because the system has been kind to them. There are a few things we can do as consumers, and buying fair trade products is definitely one of them, and we should be doing that and making sure that if we buy timber, it's been certified by the Forest Stewardship Council, and if we buy fish, it's been certified by the Marine Stewardship Council and all the rest of it. Those are all positive things we can do as consumers, but the problem is we have no negative power. We can buy fairly traded chocolate, but that doesn't stop other people from buying chocolate which involves slavery in the Ivory Coast. Now, to exercise what's called negative power, which means the power to prevent people from doing unjust things, you cannot use the market for that alone. You cannot use this very weak force called consumerism for that. There has to be government involved. And again, it's an argument against the idea that we can do all this by ourselves. And there's an overlap between part of the anarchist agenda and part of the consumerist market-led agenda, which says we can all act autonomously, we don't need government involved. And I think that's a grotesque fallacy.
I get you. Well, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with George Monbiot, author of the new book, Bring On the Apocalypse. George, one of your six arguments is about money. Banks here are folding. The biggest mortgage companies are bust, and there's trillions lost. I wonder, will the corporate capitalist system get weak enough to allow meaningful change, or will it still be strong enough to do anything at all? What's your thoughts?
Well, this is a very interesting question, and in times of recession and economic hardship, you see two contradictory trends at work. One of them is that as people feel less secure, they concentrate on economic issues at the cost of other issues. And so in those situations, they're less likely to be concerned about the environment, for example, than when they're prosperous. But it's also the case that when times are tight, people are more likely to complain and to campaign and to protest against the government, to take to the streets. And it was certainly the case in the early 1990s in the UK when we were in much more economic trouble than we've been in since, that people were far more prepared to protest. And the minority of those who were concerned about the environment were prepared to throw themselves in front of bulldozers and to take a whole series of actions like that, which since about 1996 they've been much less prepared to do. And it's only really been in the last couple of years or so that we've seen a resurgence of environmental direct action here, and I think that is partly connected to people's economic prospects. Of course, at the same time, a recession is one of the only things which could give us some breathing space, could buy us a bit of time in terms of preventing carbon emissions from spiraling out of control. And there's a very close relationship between economic growth and productivity and the amount of carbon dioxide you produce. And a few years of recession, painful and unpleasant as it would be, would give governments, if they only chose to use it, an opportunity perhaps to get carbon emissions under control.
What is one of your favorite essays from this new book? Could you pick one?
Oh, gosh. Right, well, I suppose the one which I think about most some time after reading it was one which was a bit left field, and it concerned what you could call the mystery of our existence. I became very interested at one point in the idea of literal reincarnation. I'm not interested in the idea of life after death as understood by Christians or indeed by quite a few other religions. I'm much more interested in life after death as understood by ecologists, and I find something very comforting about the idea that when I die and the molecules of which my body is composed are disaggregated, that if I'm buried in the right place, they will be absorbed and made use of by the ecosystem, that I will become part of a tree and part of the caterpillars that eat that tree and part of the birds that eat that caterpillar, those caterpillars. And it seems to me that there's something much more certain and therefore more comforting in that thought than in the awful lottery of judgment. It's a future that you can predict rather than one that's committed to the whims of the inscrutable authority in the form of God. And eternal death, accompanied by that idea of literal reincarnation, of turning into the meat of other creatures, is a happier prospect than eternal life, which could go either way, according to the big monotheist religions.
I can't stand the rain against my window.
That's UK columnist George Monbiot. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, and we'll be back with more Monbiot in just 1 minute.
Bringing back sweet memories. I can't stand the ride against my window. Cause he ain't here with me. Hey, window pane, tell me, do you remember how sweet it used to be?
Bring On the Apocalypse, that's the title of a new collection of essays by George Monbiot, the award-winning columnist from The Guardian newspaper and author of Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. We're going to go back to our interview with George. We've got questions. And your new book covers a lot on the American political failures, like the lies behind the war in Iraq. I'm wondering, what's your take on the presidential candidates?
Well, I certainly see some hope in Obama, and there's no question that he's a much better prospect than George Bush has ever been, and a rather better prospect than John McCain. But I do think that there's a great fallacy in American politics, which involves placing a huge amount of hope in a single personality and imagining that that person alone can transform the system through sheer willpower. The problems in U.S. politics go much, much deeper than that. And we've already seen the emergence of some of those problems in the policies that Obama has spelled out. For example, he has been supporting some pretty unpleasant foreign policy initiatives, including this crazy and incredibly destructive Bush doctrine of welcoming India into the nuclear club, even though it has refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and has been developing nuclear weapons outside that treaty. Now, in doing so, Bush is effectively destroying the most important of all the international peace treaties, and that threatens the world with a new nuclear escalation, which could in fact be far more dangerous than the Cold War was, because there will be an asymmetry of nuclear forces and much greater temptation on the part of new nuclear powers to use their new toys. Now, anyone would imagine that a socially aware Democratic candidate who was concerned about the future of the world would be the first to say this is outrageous and has to stop. But because of the political constraints that Obama, like every other candidate, is subject to, he did the opposite. And he's actually come out in favor of it, as indeed has John McCain. And that one fact alone suggests to me that people are deceiving themselves about this election. Yes, he's going to be better, but the issue of campaign finance still exists, that the great majority of legislators in Washington owe their position to corporate interests who have funded them, and they are not going to offend those corporate interests. And the reason why this India deal is going ahead is that it then enables the U.S. to sell civil nuclear power components to India, and that could lead to contracts worth tens of billions. That's the only reason why Bush is tearing up the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And Obama's not going to go against that, because his own party is in hock to the same interests. It owes those same corporations, and so it's not going to offend them. Similarly, Obama by himself can't deal with the U.S. media, and the U.S. media is this incredibly corrosive influence, extremely destructive of democratic politics. And to succeed in the U.S., a politician has to some extent to dance to the media's tune and to appease the lobby groups which are championed by the media, which is why we saw this extraordinary performance of Obama's at the AIPAC meeting, where he took a position which was extremely one-sided in favoring Israel at the expense of the occupied territories. And so, no, my hopes for Obama are limited.
Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there. I'm hearing in many of the things that you've said that we need a government, but we need a good government and a real democratic government. We've been talking with George Monbiot, author of Bring On the Apocalypse from Grove Atlantic Press. It's coming into the bookstores now. Thank you so much for your time and insight, George.
Thank you. That's my pleasure, Alex.
All right. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Find out more about today's guest at monbiot.com. Hey, you think your weather's been bad? 2008 has been the year of extreme rain. Like a series of giant storms all over the world and big dumpers that set records everywhere you look. Here are just a few wet samples. California 2008, the year of extreme rain began there in January, the month when Los Angeles received more rain than it normally gets all year. You know about Myanmar, the most deadly rains fell there in May, and the country formerly known as Burma. On May 2nd and 3rd, more than 95% of all the buildings in the Irrawaddy Delta were destroyed. The UN estimated between 80,000 and 125,000 people were killed, with millions homeless. Heavy rains were a huge factor there in the flooding, along with the storm surge. Tampa, Florida set their record on April 7th, their all-time record. British Columbia, Canada, July 4th, what a way to celebrate Canada there. Well, they had nearly 8 inches of rain and about, well, that's 200 millimeters, fell in just 2 hours in the normally dry hot spot of Lytton, B.C. Rail cars were just washed away. Orlando, Florida set their new all-time record on September 3rd, 2 inches in just 24 hours. Toronto, Canada, well, the most rain in a summer. On Saturday, says one newspaper, we smashed the previous summer record rainfall set back in 1986, when 335 millimeters of precipitation fell between June 1st and August 31st, but now they beat that record. City infrastructure was strained. Toronto got 5 times the rain of the famously wet Vancouver. Well, happy summer to you all down there in Toronto. Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, same thing. August, the wettest month ever recorded. Normal rainfall of 87 millimeters swelled to over 230 millimeters. Over to India and Patna, India, they experienced 3 times the normal rain for the June-July period. Bismarck, North Dakota, the National Weather Service says Bismarck, Grand Forks, and Fargo were hit with record rain levels on Labor Day, this Labor Day, September 1st. Even in the normally dry Gulf, look at Dubai. Record rain has put pressure on dams, says the August 4th article published. Well, dams across the UAE collected record amounts of water in the last 2 years, with unprecedented seasonal rainfall as well as Cyclone Gonu putting more pressure on the water barriers. Dublin, August 9, 2008, a cleanup operation is taking place in Dublin after Saturday's flash floods. Well, in 24 hours, they got 76.2 millimeters of rain at the Dublin airport. Columbia, Missouri, July 21st, the National Weather Service reported 4.4 inches of rain since midnight at the University of Missouri. 3 inches fell at the Columbia Regional Airport. Both of these totals would break the record for precipitation on this day, set in 1874. St. Louis, Missouri, the National Weather Service says St. Louis set a new record rainfall in the month of March, 8.4 inches. The old record was set in 1897. We know that Florida got soaked and soaked and then soaked again with Hurricane Fay. It may be the fourth wettest tropical cyclone to hit Florida. There was over 26 inches of rain fell in a 24-hour period in Melbourne. And I know that up at Cape Canaveral, they set another record, all-time record, of over 22 inches of rain falling. Again, back to India, Jamshedpur, and that really is the steel city. And if the weather gods played their part, well, they got 338 millimeters of rainfall in 1 day, the highest in 6 decades. Over to Hong Kong, China, total rainfall recorded at Hong Kong Observatory in June reached 1,346 millimeters, breaking the previous monthly record rainfall set in May 1889. The accumulated rainfall since January was 80% above normal. They set a record in the normally dry Waco, Texas, in August 19th. In one day, Waco saw 3.48 inches of rain, breaking the earlier record set in 1915. Manitowoc, Wisconsin, the National Weather Service of Green Bay reported 3.63 inches of rain came down on Thursday, just one day, knocking out the city's previous record set in 1925. Loveland, Ohio, March 18th, the week and a half after the Loveland area experienced a record snowfall, record rain has fallen on the area. 2 to 3 inches of rain falling in one 24-hour period. It caused flooding, the usual basement flooding and all that. Well, we saw on the news, everybody saw it, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, totally flooded out. At least 24,000 people had to be removed from their homes. Record rains were a big part in that whole swelling of the rivers in the Midwest and right down the Mississippi. Town after town had to be evacuated or worried about their levees. Heavy, heavy rainfall events behind that. The whole thing spread over into Asia. They had wild flooding happening in the Mekong River there. It's affected parts of Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, and Laos with really super heavy rains. In the dry season, the Mekong is the world's 11th longest river, but the flooding was over 14 meters above the normal level. In Bihar, India, as you've seen on the television, millions of people have been stranded and many dead after a flooded river from heavy rains up in Nepal burst the banks, and it also flooded great areas in Nepal, too. So heavy rainfall events happening in Nepal and northern India. Well, we're going back to Vietnam. Officials say that emergency supplies have reached nearly all those affected by the recent heavy flooding in northern Vietnam. And that was on the 22nd of August. Because of global warming, Vietnam is experiencing more floods and disasters, said Setsuko Yamazaki, director of the UN Development Program, addressing an interagency briefing this week on the damage done by the latest storm. 133 people killed, 34 missing. They're in Vietnam. The rains continued into southern China, that poor area hit by the earthquakes. In early August, the heavy rains caused thousands of people to evacuate. 91,000 at least had to flee their homes after torrential rainfalls. The downpours killed 9 people in Anhui province and affected 2.6 million others there. 38,000 homes destroyed. Huge areas of crops were flooded. Really a terrible situation for them in southern China. And it's just been continuing on with more storms in southern China since then. So that's just a small sampling. Radio EcoShock is working on a special for extreme rainfall events. If you have tips and information to contribute, write us at radio@ecoshock.org. We'll find the experts who keep the records and interview those scientists who can explain how climate change drives these extreme rainfall events. We'll also cruise a few city engineers to see how cities can adapt and what it will cost to keep your house dry. Look for that in late October on Radio EcoShock. Ready for the rain? Okay, so where do we stand? Are we still warming? So far, 2008, despite its storms and coldness in some areas, is still warmer than any year in the 1980s. When we add up the global average, one of the strongest signs is this. The Arctic ice is again melting massively. Depending on the weather in the far north this September, the ice melt may reach the jaw-dropping all-time record set in 2007. We are still headed towards an open Arctic sea in the summer. All that dark water will add more warming to the sea as it soaks up the sun. Just how this big change in the Arctic will affect our year-on-year weather is not really known. We're losing our big cooler. But we know the long-term impact on climate will be toward a warmer world. Scientists have just recently doubled their estimates of the amount of greenhouse gases stored in the Arctic permafrost all these many thousands of years. As the Arctic warms, as the permafrost releases carbon and methane, our human contribution may matter less. In a recent speech released in August 2008, Dr. James Hansen, the famous NASA scientist, warned we have already passed several tipping points. Here's a clip from UCTV from the University of California Frontiers of Knowledge series.
The climate system can reach tipping points where things begin to happen rapidly and out of our control. And that's the danger. Now, the good news is, and I'm going to argue, and I think convincingly, that we have actually already passed the level of CO2 that we can afford to have in the atmosphere on the long term. We're going to have to roll back the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And it's still technically feasible, and there are advantages in doing that, but there are special interests who make it very difficult to get this to happen. Part of the problem is that weather fluctuations are so large. The temperature can change by 10 or 20 degrees from one day to another. And even if you average the temperature over a month, as has been done here, the anomalies in the last 4 months, there are some places, some months that it's warmer than normal and some months it's colder than normal, where normal is the 1950 to 1980 average. But if you average the temperature over the first 7 years of this century, you see the patterns become clear, and it's just the nature that we expect for global warming. The warming is larger over land than it is over the ocean because the ocean has thermal inertia and it's only partially responded to the forcing. The warming's larger at high latitudes than low latitudes because of the amplifying feedbacks at high latitudes. As ice and snow melt, the surface is darker and absorbs more sunlight, and that's a positive feedback. And it's larger in the northern hemisphere than in the southern hemisphere, partly because of the larger amount of ocean in the southern hemisphere, and it's particularly small around the Antarctic, where the ocean mixes deeply. The warming in the last century is now about 8/10 of a degree Celsius, which is about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, with 3/4 of that warming coming in the last 30 years.
That one-hour presentation by Dr. James Hansen is titled The Threat to the Planet. Google that plus UCTV, and you'll find the whole speech as a free video. The Brookings Institute, not known for its really radical thought, has written an op-ed in the Washington Post, August 28th, titled 7 Years to Climate Midnight. They write, quote, "The world may have only 7 years to start reducing the annual buildup in greenhouse gas emissions that otherwise threaten global catastrophe within several decades. That means that between Inauguration Day in January 2009 and 2015, either John McCain or Barack Obama will face the most momentous political challenge of all time." End quote. You can also find that piece at www.brookings.edu. This is startling stuff, especially when you find out how weak the climate promises are from both candidates. Both put climate into the end of a long list of social needs, near the bottom somewhere, after better schools or lower taxes. Both Obama and McCain want more nuclear power plants. Maybe they'll build one near you. Not that it matters, since radioactive emissions from an accident can travel around the world. Or maybe the hot fuel and waste trucks will share your highway. Worse, if that can be imagined, both Obama and McCain continue to promote the coal lobby's dirty business, hitting the well-advertised button, clean coal. You and I know there is no clean coal plant anywhere on this planet. Not one. It's a kind of Orwellian marriage of opposite words. Like, say, humane genocide, and it may be genocide or mass deaths for most mammals if all the planned coal plants are built. That is the road to mass extinction. There have been 5 mass extinctions before us. Many scientists believe we are already experiencing the 6th extinction. It is only a matter of how much of nature we kill off before we try to stop the carnage. Carbon emissions are not falling, but are growing daily, massively, all over the world. Whether we have a cooler year or a warmer one is no longer the point. The carbon adds up mercilessly in the air. Parts of our drive home, our vacation flight, the light in my room will remain in the upper atmosphere for 1,000 years. And each day, I add more. We are changing the atmosphere. There is not even a global agreement to save it. That is where we stand. Over the next few months, I'll be riding this storm out with you, trying to see through the dust of the lies we tell ourselves. Coming up soon, Dr. Peter Ward, author of Under a Green Sky, he'll explain how the past can come back, how the Earth shuttles between ice world and the greenhouse world. I found out about this extraordinary book during an interview of Dr. David Bushnell, chief scientist at NASA's Langley operation, by KMO, host of the Sea Realm podcast, Bushnell seemed to say that Peter Ward's book had changed the game. Indeed it has. Now we know what killed off past species, what made the dead zones in the geological record. In most cases, it was not an asteroid or a comet from outer space, but climate change originating here on Earth. We'll find out more with Dr. Peter Ward. All this complements the work of Dr. Andrew Glickson of Australia. We broadcast his speech called A Warning from the Past on the July 4th, 2008 Radio EcoShock show. If you haven't heard it, please download Dr. Glickson's speech from www.ecoshock.org. You'll see a link to our past shows on the main page. Andrew Glickson has helped organize a large group of Australian scientists sending an open letter to Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. The scientists warn that we have only a precious few years to act to reverse our greenhouse footprint before an unthinkable disaster strikes our descendants and even our own lives. Glickson has sent recent papers, including two very shocking graphs, to me. One reports a type of testing of Greenland ice cores using deuterium. It finds, quote, sharp climate tipping points at 14,700, 12,900, and 11,700 years ago, end quote. Abrupt warming can occur within 1 to 3 years. We are totally unprepared, mentally and socially, for the possibility of such a rapid climate shift. Well, that paper is Warnings from the Past, Implications of Abrupt Atmospheric Changes in the Recent History of the Earth for 21st Century Climate Projections. Glickson begins the paper with this quote by Wallace Smith Brocker, known as Wally. He's a professor at Columbia University and a scientist at Columbia's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. Brocker wrote in 1987, "The inhabitants of Earth are quietly conducting a gigantic experiment. So vast and sweeping will be the consequences that, were it brought before any responsible council for approval, it would be firmly rejected. Yet it goes on with little interference from any jurisdiction or nation. We play Russian roulette with the climate, hoping that the future will hold no unpleasant surprises. No one knows what lies in the active chamber of the gun, but I am less optimistic about its contents than many. The paleoclimate record shouts to us that, far from being self-stabilizing, the climate system is an ornery beast which overreacts even to small nudges," end quote. When we began our riot of energy, my friends, you and I, from the long-buried solar energy as oil and gas and coal, we had no idea that our climate could change, much less its sensitivity to small nudges. In a personal email, Andrew Glickson explains, "The potential of the atmosphere for violent backlash has been underestimated. A good comparison is with the lungs. Once pneumonia takes hold and temperature rises, a threshold is reached upon which the bacterial pollution explodes. Life is only saved if antibiotics are taken at the right dose, at the right time, much like climate change mitigation," end quote. Another of Andrew Glickson's graphs, summarizing studies from all over the world, finds a spike of 8 degrees Celsius happened in only 70 years. Is that our future? Are you willing to let that happen? During the last great greenhouse world, as reptiles sheltered at the poles to escape the heat, only the smallest mammals survived by living underground in burrows. Is that our future? Perhaps the only rational response is depression, utter desperation. Fortunately, we're not only rational animals. We have, I believe, a strong urge to survive. People willingly died for nations and beliefs in past wars. As George Monbiot says, the climate is not asking you to give your life. Just some small sacrifices and a change from unlimited expectations. We may even enjoy life more, knowing we are not killing off other living things and ourselves. If you are just tuning in, this is Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith. We had an exclusive interview with one of the UK's top writers and activists, George Monbiot. If you missed it, download this program free from ecoshock.org. Not everyone agrees with Monbiot, of course, even among concerned citizens. You can find a debate at monbiot.com, because in the May-June issue of the New Left Review, number 45, Clive Hamilton critically reviews Monbiot's call for a 90% reduction of greenhouse gas emissions in the developed countries. Hamilton suggests Monbiot is unrealistic, asking too much, setting a goal that we can't attain. Hamilton writes, "Very few people, even among environmentalists, have truly faced up to what the science is telling us. Those who have cannot shake off a profound fear for the future and lead lives blighted by this knowledge." End quote. Well, yes, Clive, I do have a profound fear for the future, but no, my life is not blighted by this knowledge. It is empowered by it. And I still hope. I hope, well, it's corny, but because there's love and because I feel joy during each and every day. The future is still possible. We can seize our own joy in living and put it to work. In the coming Radio EcoShock programs, you will hear voices of hope, however tenuous. Texas University professor Robert Jensen suggests we have failed, and now we must regroup. Here's a clip.
One moment where I think a lot of these issues can be crystallized. I don't know where you all were on February 15th, 2003, but that was the Worldwide Day of Action during the run-up to the Iraq War. Worldwide, the estimates are somewhere from 10 to 15 million people came out on that day. It was the largest coordinated day of political activity in the history of the world, and it had exactly zero effect on the course of politics.
We'll examine Robert Jensen's speech and rejoinders from the audience and the implications for new social movements, because we need new social movements. We need to change to save ourselves. And then we'll add this man, one of the iconic veteran activists of our time, Tom Hayden.
Because politics, according to Machiavelli, has its own unique moral foundation, which is the accumulation and holding of power for its own sake. So today these would be the manipulative power technicians who work for the corporations and the government and the media and the entertainment industry and so on. They're always faced by public opinion, nasty little factor. And public opinion is always shaped by social movements. So social movements against Machiavellians is the idea.
While in Vancouver, Hayden summed up his experience, his decades with new social movements, coming when least expected, always unofficially. Again, I have an original recording for you of both the speech and the Q&A session, with the audience being mostly college students. Will Students for a Democratic Society be reborn to confront new challenges? We'll also have two surprise guests in coming weeks, each with ideas of hope, ways we can change society socially to survive our own civilization. Thank you for being a part of this activist radio. I'm Alex Smith. This has been the Radio EcoShock Show. Find us on your local college or community radio stations or at ecoshock.org. You know, good planets are hard to find, and that's what Steve Forbert is singing about in this 1996 song, Steve Forbert.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes and true currents in thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Good planets are what? Hard to find. Good planets are in demand. Clean beaches and sparkling sands and the land masses, room to spare. That's good, yeah. Jet streams and perfect air. High forests and low wetlands are good planets are in demand. And the mind don't know. Yeah, the heart can't see. Let the blind man go to his destiny. Yeah. Good planets are rare indeed. Rain falling on crops and seed. Big rivers and good topsoil. fuel sources from cane to oil, green garden of all that we need, good planets are rare indeed. Let the blind